And Uwe and Jürgen, the floor is yours.
Thanks a lot. So I will just pick it up from here. This is Jürgen from the German Space Agency, DLR. And we're talking today about a study that we conducted over the course of the last 2 years. Essentially a study that was conducted by Airbus, but it was co-financed by the German Space Agency, and that's the reason why we split this between Uwe and myself, where I will give a little bit of a programmatic introduction, basically giving you a little bit of a framework of where we stand in Europe and in Germany in terms of space exploration, particularly human space exploration activities, and why we conducted the study and what the intent of the study was, whereas Uwe will then go into more details of the concepts and the technical details that they were looking at Airbus. So I'm moving to slide two then. Basically, as a preface to that, I just tried to put down a little bit of a summary where we stood with human spaceflight and exploration in Europe at the time when we started the study, and it has not changed too much until now, is that we have obviously the ISS utilization as the core of the human spaceflight activities in Europe and particularly also in Germany. And we have the European service module for the MPCV, where we expect from 2021 to have increased cislunar activities with humans going on using the Orion and the SLS capabilities. At the same time, in Europe, there are robotic exploration activities going on in partnerships. We have, for example, the ExoMars program with the Russians. We're looking into participation to the lunar missions that the Russians are planning. There are many other activities that I have not yet listed here. And when we look at the German National Space Strategy, we say that really the utilization aspect, including the scientific aspects of exploration, are the core of the German space activities. And this is one of the reasons why we focus human spaceflight very much on the ISS currently. And that for all of the exploration activities, we need to have very clear scientific goals, both in the human and robotic elements, but there is also a certain priority on robotic and automation activities to some extent. So when we then look at the larger international picture, and that's where DLR is most active in the discussion at the International Space Exploration Coordination Group, we go to slide three. We look at the ISEC mission scenario, and we thought in this framework, where basically international space agencies discussed what could be potentially future missions that develop after the ISS. And what you see here is three major activities that are expected to be the themes of human space exploration in, let's say, the next 15 years. And that is, on the one hand, the Asteroid Redirect Initiative that is being pushed forward in the U.S. right now. There is the possibility of access to humans to lunar surface in the late 2020s. But there is, particularly in the middle of those and the lunar vicinity, potential extended duration crew missions to assist lunar infrastructure. And that's the reason why we thought that we needed to take a closer look at the capabilities of such a cislunar infrastructure, but also the opportunities that it would enable in terms of scientific utilization, in terms of utilization that goes beyond what we could do in low Earth orbit, where we expect the International Space Station or and other infrastructures to continue to provide opportunities, research opportunities in LEO. So moving to slide four, then we had a few of the underlying questions to look at this deep space habitat, or this free flyer for exploration, as we called it for the study. That is, when we looked at low Earth exploration activities, we found in many discussions with scientists that the microgravity research is not expected to be a large driver for human infrastructures in LEO, knowing that a lot of the activities could be also carried out potentially in more autonomous systems, in capsule systems or smaller free flyer systems. But we might have very much more limited crew time in low Earth orbit after the ISS. So the big question was, where and how do we address life sciences research then, where we need to have crew present? So we have to look at where is crew going? Where are the actual human activities going on? And that's why we looked at the cislunar infrastructure then, where we see that institutional activities post-ISS go to beyond LEO destinations. And we need to understand what role Germany or Europe wants to take in that and what research themes are possible in this kind of setting that cannot be addressed in low Earth orbit. So starting the study from these questions, we then said we want to really look at, as an objective of the study, the utilization aspects for such a free flyer. What are the research themes that are enabled? To look at understanding the technical concept, what do you need in terms of technologies and capabilities, what are the German or European competences, particularly with respect to the utilization aspect, where do we want to put a priority or an intensity in our preparatory work, and we wanted to identify potential relevant contributions to such an infrastructure. So with all this framework, I think it really helps in understanding much more the technical solutions that we looked at, or that and especially the Airbus team looked at in the study. And I will want to already leave it at that and give the floor to Uwe now to go in more detail of the technical aspect and the concepts that they looked at for such a free flyer from Site 5. So Uwe, please go on.
Yeah. Thank you. So my name is Uwe Deritz. I'm working for the Future Projects Group of Airbus DS in Bremen in Germany. I was responsible for leading this activity, and we from Airbus DS worked as prime, where we had the University of Stuttgart as the subcontractor responsible for the ECLS system. So this study is mainly on phase zero level, so it was mainly to confirm feasibility and to identify critical technologies. So it's not the ambition here to present a design which can be implemented straight away. So please go to the slide 6. Here I'm recalling just the objectives which Jürgen gave. This is also my outline of this presentation. In the beginning, I will have one slide on the research fields and with the resulting orbit trade-off we performed. In the second part of this presentation, we will have a look at two concepts we investigated. And finally, we will have a look at potential European contributions. So going to slide 7, as Jürgen outlined already in the German space strategy calls for a very solid scientific justification for any future human spaceflight project. And here we identified in particular two research fields as interesting, and in particular the combination of those two. On one hand, this is the gravitational biology, and on the other hand, the radiation biology. Research on board the ISS indicated that there is a connection between the biological repair mechanisms of radiation damages in connection with gravity. So this means, in order to investigate this, that on one hand, we need artificial gravity. On the other hand, we would like to have radiation. And it would be even better if we could vary this radiation level. In terms of a space station, this would mean that we would have parts which are almost unshielded and parts which would be shielded to a level which is subject to also the scientific value. And of course, in order to get an radiation which is probably representative for the interplanetary environment, we have to go beyond low Earth orbit, because otherwise we are shielded by Earth and its magnetosphere as well as its atmosphere. In order to perform those experiments, it's very beneficial to have crew on board, and in a first assessment, we think that a three-person crew is sufficient for our task. Since we have a relatively specific scientific goal for such a mission, we consider a lifetime of this infrastructure of 5 years as sufficient. So it's not that we would suggest a permanent infrastructure. The now following research and activity fields are more related to technology development and demonstration towards future human deep space missions. At first, we have human performance and health, which is, of course, related to the first point, in particular to the artificial gravity. Here, we would like to estimate the increase of performance the human body can get if we perform training in artificial gravity. And in particular, we would like to determine to what extent the humans, after traveling to Mars, would be able to set up their initial base after half a year in microgravity. The next point is future closed-loop life support systems. On one hand, this is related to the fact that we would like to reduce the consumable amounts we have to transport to this infrastructure to as far as possible. On the other hand, again, future human deep space mission will need closed-loop life support systems for sure. So here it's really to perform a long time test and purposely even the qualification of those systems. In general, the station should be able to host technology demonstrations for such emissions. And the further aspect is potential robotic assistance or robot tail operations. This is related on one hand to operate the free flyer when it's not manned. So this infrastructure is even not necessary crewed all the time. And also, this infrastructure shall support robotic assets or assets on the lunar surface, either that we control it via relay, the stations are from ground, or that the crew on board performs those robotic operations to demonstrate also technologies and operations for future human missions. So, going to slide 8, based on that, those objectives, we investigated several destinations for such a free flyer, ranging on one hand from GEO to low lunar orbit and the Earth-Moon Librations points 1 and 2, as well as 4 and 5. Our trade-off resulted in the selection of the EML-2. I think this point is already so much in discussion that I'm not repeating the usual pictures on what a libration point is. But what is important from my perspective is the pictures on the right-hand side. They are showing the actual orbit, so we are not situated in the libration point itself, but we are flying in a so-called halo orbit around it. So we have basically three main reasons that we selected the libration point to. First, we're getting an environment which is almost similar to the interplanetary radiation environment. For example, in GEO and in low Earth orbit, this environment would be disturbed by either the Earth magnetosphere and, in case of the Moon, the shielding from the celestial body itself. The second point is that we are able to communicate with the lunar far side. So on one hand, we can provide data relay, as shown in the upper picture. On the other hand, we have continuous contact to Earth. For example, this would not be the case in all low lunar orbits. Last but not least, we have the opportunity to use relatively low delta V transfers to this operational orbit. However, we have to distinguish between two types of transfers. On one hand, we have the transfers for human missions, which are using a lunar swingby, as is already foreseen for the first Orion missions. For cargo missions, we foresee so-called weak stability boundary transfers, which takes much more time but requires even less delta V. Anyway, those transfers will require much more delta V and or much more performance from the launch vehicle, as if you're going just to low Earth orbit. This means, of course, that research in the libration point is much more costly than in doing it in low Earth orbit. And therefore, we do not think that microgravity research should be conducted on such a free flyer, because it is much more easy to conduct it in low Earth orbit. Going to slide 9, we are starting with the first main design driver we identified within the course of the study. This is the actual the artificial gravity, which has to be provided by means of centrifugal force. In principle, two options exist to provide this environment. On one hand, you can install a centrifuge, which could be even sufficiently larger to host even crew members. On the other hand, we could rotate the entire station. The centrifuge solution has the nice benefit that we can easily vary the magnitude of artificial gravity, and it could be even hosted inside a conventional space station module. For example, several years ago, there was a proposal to fly such a centrifuge on board an ATV and to conduct artificial gravity experiments on board the ISS. However, this was not continued after phase B because it would disturb the microgravity level on the station, and the introduced free vibrations are in a critical range for the docking adapter. However, this solution has the drawback that we can expose the crew members only for a relatively limited time to this artificial gravity. In principle, the idea is that the crew members would perform their daily training on this centrifuge. However, therefore, especially due to this limitation, we investigated also the other option to rotate the entire habitat. Here we have the major benefit that the crew is continuously exposed to this gravity and can even adapt to it. And since the crew members are working throughout the day in this artificial gravity, even the time which is required for training may be reduced. Unfortunately, this solution requires a propellant to modify your gravitational level. So the idea would be that you decide which level you have at the beginning of the mission, and then maintaining this level until the end of the mission. In principle, you could achieve also quite high gravity levels with this configuration. However, in order to reduce the disturbing forces as the Coriolis force, you have to increase the radius of the station quite significantly, which of course has a significant mass impact and also an impact on the propellant need. Therefore, we limit the gravity level to Mars level in order to relieve the dimensions of the station in reasonable ranges. Going to the next slide, 10, we are having a look at the first configuration using this human short arm centrifuge. You see this artist impression with on the right-hand side with the docked Orion spacecraft. Beside this, there is a conventional rigid core module, which is basically derived from ISS technology. On left from this module, you see an enlarger one, an inflatable module, which is somehow based on the technology of Bigelow. And on the left side, you see a logistics vehicle docked to this station. It should be mentioned that this station is every time oriented towards the Earth in order to point the high-gain antenna to it, and also there is a second high-gain antenna which can be pointed to the Moon. The solar arrays shall be oriented all the time perpendicular to the Earth-Moon plane in order to provide continuously power support. Going to slide 11, we have a look on a more detailed level of the spacecraft. seeing this Sion module on the right-hand side top, you see this entire spacecraft configuration. This Sion module is this mentioned rigid core module. It consists, as you can see on the bottom left, of a pressurized shell, which is marked Sion, and inside there we have a standard REC system marked in dark blue. On the right-hand side of this pressure shell, we have a radiation shelter in order to protect the crew from the solar particle events. This module, however, shall also provide communication as well as power, thermal control, and propulsion. Those functions are located in unpressurized sections at the end of this module. Those sections, however, also include a pressurized tunnel which offers the crew access to other docked vehicles. In yellow, you see this inflatable module. This has, on one hand, this flexible shell, which is pressurized after a launch or after docking to the station, and then is rigidized by UV radiation. So this is basically similar to the Bigelow concept. Inside this module, you find a rigid structure which is carrying the loads during launch and is hosting the centrifuge, which introduces also significant loads when it's in operation. The reason why we're going for such an inflatable module is that from ISS, we know that if you have an experiment which has to deploy it and undeploy it afterwards, this experiment is usually not used so often because of the effort in order to deploy it. So we decided to reserve a volume for the centrifuge so that the operation of the centrifuge is quite straightforward and there is not, let's say, a large effort to set the system up. The core module, the major requirement for this core module was that we shall be able to launch it in one piece with an SLS launch vehicle. This inflatable module can be launched with a medium launch vehicle, let us say Ariane 5, H2, Atlas 5, something like this, and is transferred separately to the liberation point and docked to it there. And anyway, the total mass of the station is about 40 tons, which is significantly lower than the ISS. And this was also one major requirement, that this infrastructure shall be significantly smaller than the ISS. Going to page 12, we have the second concept, or an artist's impression of it. Here we have the Orion spacecraft connected via tethers with our habitat module. As you may know, there are several concepts to perform a rotation of the entire habitat. In particular, those concepts are suggested in connection with a human mission to Mars. And there, usually, Mars orbit injection stage is used as the counterweight towards the habitat module. Unfortunately, we have not such a propulsion stage in case of a EML2 station. So we had a lot of thoughts what we could do, and in order not to just launch Mars, in order to have a counterweight, we decided to use the Orion spacecraft itself as the counterweight. Going to the page 13, we have, again, a more detailed overview of this configuration. On the upper hand right, you see the station in non-rotating state, where we have on one hand, in Xi'an again, the habitation module. This module is designed to operate in microgravity as well as in Mars gravity. It has a much larger diameter in order to fit in all the necessary subsystems. And this means, of course, that we need a larger launch vehicle fairing in comparison to the actual one. Then we have a so-called transfer module. This module is displayed in blue and gray between the Orion and the habitat module. The blue rings are docking adapters, which stay connected to the Orion and the habitat module when the system is rotating. And between those two docking adapters, tethers will be unrolled. The transfer module itself is a pressurized compartment which can move along those tethers. We will come to this point on the next slide in a bit more detail. The core module shall be launched with an SLS. Here we had the issue that not the entire radiation protection could be launched together with the module. This we will address also in a few minutes when we come to the operational scenario. Anyway, the mass of the station is significantly higher as the previous concept, even if the pressurized volume is in the same order of magnitude. Actually, this is driven by the fact that we have on one hand the rotation, and on the other hand that we, in order to provide rotation of the entire system, we need more propellant to spin up and spin down the entire system. Interestingly, an ESA study on the human Mars mission estimated the effort to include artificial gravity by means of entire habitat rotation to about 20%. And this is actually, we are quite actually in this range. We are probably a bit higher at 23-24%. So on page 14, on the next one, we have a look at this mentioned transfer module. In order to spin up the entire station, we first would have to de-dock eventual logistics vehicles. If this is performed, then the Orion spacecraft and the habitat fires the attitude control thrusters to spin up the entire system up to a rotation rate of 4 rotations per minute. This is actually the highest value which can be considered as comfortable for the crew. So even lower rotational rates could be desirable. However, this would need an increase in radius of the station. The inside the, when we're doing this rotation, inside the core module, we have a rotation of Mars level, so almost 0.4 G. Inside the logistics vehicle, we have almost 0 G. So it could be an interesting opportunity to host reference experiments in this logistics vehicle. And after the entire habitat and Orion system is despun, we can redock this logistics vehicle and extract the samples. And last but not least, in principle, there's also the possibility to host reference experiments inside the MPCV itself. There we would have almost 1G gravity. So when we are rotating, of course, there could be the necessity to transfer crew to the Orion spacecraft. In particular, in case of a contingency, we would like to evacuate the core module quite fast and would not like to rely on a despin of the entire system. So we included this mentioned pressurized compartment, which is displayed in the middle on the right-hand side. There the crew can go in, close the hatch, and transfer along the tether system. When it's reaching the Orion spacecraft, it can connect it to it, can transfer in this Orion, and the connection can be cut by pyroballs in order to separate the Orion spacecraft quite rapidly. Since we are rotating and when we're cutting in this situation the tethers, both elements will fly in a tangential way, so they would not endanger each other. Going to the next page, number 15, we have a first look on the operational scenario. So on the top, you see a table illustrating the various missions which shall fly towards the station. Please ignore the figures on the bottom right. Here I made a mistake when made this slide. Anyway, we will launch at first, of course, this core module, followed by the transfer module as well as water for radiation protection. When those three elements reach the EML2 and are docked to each other, the first crew will be launched. In this scenario, we will have in total three missions, three crewed missions of 30 days each. This is mainly related to the fact that we do want to avoid the radiation protection towards galactic cosmic rays, which saves a lot of mass. However, we will need a protection against solar flares, which will be provided by radiation shelters, which we will see in a few minutes. The first mission, we will not be able to perform artificial gravity because we are limited in propellant. And here we decided not to include a dedicated propellant transfer to this, transfer vehicle to this central module in order to keep this scenario as small and as less complex as possible. On the next slide, 16, we will see a more complex scenario where we aim to have longer missions on board of this free flyer. This is mainly related to the fact that the main cost driver of the logistics is the procurement of launch vehicles. And by keeping the crew longer on board this free fly, assuming that you have a closed loop life support system, you can increase your return quite significantly. Unfortunately, this means that you have also to include radiation protection against GCR, and this requires much more flights, as can be seen from the top picture. Within the course of the 5 years of lifetime, we would increase the crewed mission time from mission to mission, starting with 30 days to set up basically the station. In the second mission, we would have first time the artificial gravity. There, we think, again, we can increase slightly the mission duration. In the end, we increasing up to 270 days. This 270 days results from the idea that we would like to simulate an entire Earth to Mars transfer. And when the crew is coming back to Earth, we can actually see how the condition of those astronauts are. And from this, hopefully, we can derive strategies or design suggestions for the actual deep space mission. In general, the later missions consist usually of one logistics flight and one crewed flight. However, the logistics flight itself would transport on one hand consumables and spare parts, on the other hand, shall transport also scientific equipment. Going to slide 17, we have a look at the ECLIS system. As you have seen on the previous two slides, we will want to minimize the logistics effort of the station, and there the ECLIS system plays a major role. In order to do so, we investigated several ECLIS configurations and determine the so-called equivalent system mass. This mass includes, on one hand, the consumables, but also the system mass itself of the ECLIS system and of the necessary power system in order to support the ECLIS system. The lines which going straight up are open-loop systems, which are obviously not a solution for this station. In the middle part, you find ECLIS configurations with a closed oxygen loop and water loop to be the most mass-efficient solution. And if you're going really to very high mission durations, you would favor also food production systems. In general, we can conclude that even for the mission durations we have in mind for this station, a closed water and oxygen loop system is very beneficial. The biological ECLIS is, let us say, not required from this station point of view. However, it may be beneficial if we are going for really long missions to Mars or so. And if we want to include this technology there, we would have to demonstrate this technology before, of course. So on the next slide, number 18, we will have a look at the radiation aspects. Those on the right-hand side, you find an artist's impression of the pressure shells. On the top, you have in yellow the radiation protection against cosmic rays. This protection only is covering the crew quarters, the living room, and the kitchen. This is because we could not protect the entire habitat from a mass point of view. And those three functions or rooms, as you like, cover basically two-thirds of the entire day of an astronaut. So by surrounding only those regions, we can reduce the radiation dose significantly. And we have the advantage that we have some volume where we can host radiation experiments, which shall be exposed to, let's say, almost normal or the environmental radiation dose of the outside. And on the other hand, you can host then also experiments inside the yellow volume, which then could be compared. And this should especially be used to validate the performance of the radiation protection. Furthermore, of course, we have the radiation protection against the solar particle events. This is here marked in green in the middle picture. Solar particle events have usually a duration of about one day, and therefore would need only very limited volume where the crew can go when this solar particle event is happening. Last but not least, we would also like to have an external platform where we could host experiments which should investigate the radiation itself or potential other aspects of the interplanetary environment without any disturbance from walls or so on, which could be between the experiment and the outer environment. On page 19... Yeah.
Uwe, this is Harley. Yeah. Got a question about radiation. As you probably know, as your colleagues probably know, NASA spends a lot of, and its contractors and so on, spends a lot of time debating and discussing and calculating radiation exposures and their biological effects. Does DLR or maybe ESA, if you know, do they have a separate or a different criteria, maximum permitted dosage, maximum allowable dosage, or do they follow, or at least approximately follow, NASA calculations and NASA restrictions on space radiation exposure?
Yeah, I think the NASA radiation requirements are based on a general radiation norm, and this is also applied in Europe. So there is a regulatory, I think, of the an organization related to radiation dosage in general, and this body is providing these limits, and this is more or less adapted in Europe. I think there are minor adaptations, but nothing major.
So one would say very similar to that which NASA has adopted. It's maybe not identical.
Yes, I think there are one or two values which are a bit different, but not significantly.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Welcome. So continuing on slide 19, we are coming to the aspects where we as Europe would like to contribute to such a station. In the past, we have been contributing to a lot of international space projects. As you may know, we were building the space lab module for the space shuttle. Actually, Germany has flown two dedicated missions on board the shuttle with this space lab. We have performed several experiments with robotics on board the space lab, but also on board the ISS. And finally, of course, we have built the Columbus module and also the scientific facilities, at least some of them, inside this module. based on that, we think that we are capable of contributing such a mission in a meaningful way. And as we have outlined before, there is a particular scientific interest in contributing to this such a station in Earth Moon Laboration Point. On one hand, in order to fulfill our scientific objectives, we would need artificial gravity. By means, we would have to discuss, of course, in an international consortium. Then we would like to vary the radiation level, or have at least different positions with different radiation levels. Also, we would like to conduct research in interplanetary environmental conditions in general. In particular, by means of an external platform. And finally, we would like to be able to perform robotic teleoperations, on one hand on the free fly itself, but also on the lunar surface. Of course, in order to get, let us say, the ability to conduct this research and activities, we would have to contribute to the common operation costs as we are doing for the ISS. And this we are addressing on the next slide, where we have outlined a few options where Europe could contribute to this common operations cost. It is clear that we would not provide everything. It's just a list we would, let us say, propose, and we have to see what is possible. On one hand, of course, we have logistics and transportation means. In the past, we have done this via ATV towards the space station, and now we are doing it via the European service module of the Orion. Also, one aspect could be closed loop life support systems. In particular, in Germany, we have projects on the closure of the O2 loop with a so-called advanced closed loop life support system. And there are a lot of activities in the area of photobioreactors. A further candidate would be laser communication. As you may know, the Copernicus system, this is a satellite constellation of Earth observation satellites, is using optical communication in connection with the so-called European Data Relay Satellite System to boost basically the downlink capabilities. And in principle, there could be the option to extend such a system or to provide a suitable optical communication terminal also for such an infrastructure in the laboration point. Finally, there is also some interest on radiation protection itself. However, here it's clear that we're at the beginning and a lot of research has to be done in this area. However, we think this station itself is really dedicated to test various radiation technologies and find the best solution for the human Mars mission in the final end. So this brings me basically to the end of my talk, and I thank you all for your attention. In the backup slides, you find the Mars budgets of the two studied configurations. And finally, you find on the last slide a configuration which we also investigated, which is somehow a bit, which was driven by some impressions of the Odyssey 2001 movie of Stanley Kubrick. And there the idea was to have a continuously rotating station. And however, we found that this concept is very complex and would lead to also very complex mechanisms and systems, that we consider the effort to implement such a system is much too high to the gain you would get in the end. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. And this is Harley again. I've got another follow-up question. And of course, and obviously other folks online can ask questions as well. I know that the launch vehicle upon which your architecture depends is heavy lift, SLS, or, you know, some, as I said, some heavy lift. There have been over the years, and maybe this has come out of your office, and so you may be vastly more familiar with this than I, There have been over the years European scenarios developed for lunar exploration that use more modest lift vehicles, you know, the equivalent of Ariane 5 or subsequent launch vehicles equivalent to Ariane 5. Is that something that you all looked at, or did you give any thought to more what you might be able to do with more modest launch vehicles?
Yes, this is actually a good question. About 7 years ago, there was a study in the frame of ESA called Exploration Architecture Study, which investigated exactly what you outlined. There we were constrained to use only Ariane 5. However, this led to very high launch rates. For example, in order to conduct a human mission just to the libration points, I think we ended up at 4 or 5 Ariane 5 launches. And considering that the current flight rate is in the area of 6 to 8 flights per year, this was considered as really a blocking point for launch providers because, for example, Arianespace, of course, would like to market their launchers towards commercial customers. Then in the following, we investigated a bit more larger launchers, so in the area of 50 tons. These were found feasible for cislunar exploration with reasonable launch rates. However, in this study here, we did not look into this because we assumed that we have not the capability to develop a new launch vehicle. You would have to use vehicles which are existing or which are currently under development. And so the launcher of the crewed missions and of the core module itself, we assumed to be the SLS. And other options were not practical in the sense that you would need a lot of rendezvous in the libration point orbit. And as you may see from the designs, they were meant to be as simple as possible. And in principle, we were asked to avoid EVA as a normal operational procedure. EVA was only considered as a contingency procedure. And this, of course, limits your capability to assemble complex structures. On the other hand, on the logistics side, we had looked on conventional launch vehicles as Ariane 5. On the found quite soon that we have a lot of payloads which consist mainly of water or propellant. And there it would be helpful to have a launch vehicle in the 50-ton range, which, for example, would be Falcon Heavy launch vehicle. So this is referred to in the mission scenarios to be this 50-ton launch vehicle, which we need in the case of the long mission durations.
Okay, thank you. Do other folks have questions?
Yeah, I have one. Uwe, this is Dan Lester. That was a really nice talk. Thank you very much. I was curious about the emphasis that you gave to artificial gravity in the habitat architecture, because, you know, your mission durations, you know, on the average are less than half a year. So, with mission durations on that order, those produce minor effects on ISS. Why is artificial gravity considered so important to your design?
The idea is that we would like to test this technology for future deep space missions when you're flying to Mars. And there on Mars, the crew would have no support at all from medical stuff or so. So the idea is here to demonstrate whether this technology is beneficial for such a mission and also to really quantify the effect you would gain. For example, if you say, okay, you could, let us say, reduce the microgravity effect sufficiently only by conventional training, is this valid or is there really a benefit by implementing artificial gravity?
Yeah, okay, that's fine. I think if you're looking ahead to future missions, beyond cislunar space, that's a very sensible thing to do. I think you hadn't mentioned that very much, though. So, okay, thank you.
Maybe if I might add a point to Jürgen. There was a second point to that, and that is what we said at the beginning, that we really wanted to have a focus on this study on understanding utilization aspects of such an infrastructure that are really unique to the location in terms of the deep space environment, in terms of the cislunar space, something that you wouldn't do on a LEO infrastructure. And there we, and Uwe stressed that in the beginning, we found this close connection between gravitational and radiation biology effects. So that was also an interest to have a possibility, a capability of varying gravity in a deep space radiation environment to understand those effects.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Artificial gravity architecture like that would be somewhat problematical in LEO. So that's a good place to do it.
And this is Tom Sullivan. I might add that by spinning at 1/6 G or 3/8 G, you might be able to investigate some of the various technologies that would be important on either the lunar or Mars surface. Things like fluid flow for flushing toilets or storing liquids, having Equus trickle bed reactors and see how three-phase flow works at lower gravity and things like that. So there's a whole host of other technologies that could be investigated besides life sciences.
Yeah, that's true. Thank you.
Other questions, folks? We got about a minute or two before we nominally end, although folks have questions. It's late in Europe, but if folks have questions, I've got a question from one of my one of the students down the hall for Uwe. What in simple terms, what next? Are you guys pursuing this design further, or alternative designs, or whatever?
In general, we are conducting still feasibility work. In particular, we found for the tethered configuration, the GNC aspect is non-trivial. We're working there on a model, basically. We currently have a 6-degree of freedom model, and the idea is to extend this model to a larger extent. And then we could judge the effort which is really necessary to implement such a tethered system. And beside this, we would need we would have to negotiate in an international frame whether this is acceptable for other partners to have artificial gravity and the way we would like to implement this. Because in principle, the two configurations differ in the objectives in the sense that the human centrifuge version would more prioritize exploration of the moon, because there you could have a conventional station with multiple docking ports, offering ports for lunar landers and so on. On the other hand, the tether configuration is more directed towards a Mars forward approach, where you say, okay, I would like to demonstrate really technologies for a deep space habitat and prioritizing this. And of course, if your system is spinning, you cannot dock any vehicles to it. And this limits, of course, your capability to support human lunar missions. So, in principle, we would hope to really reach agreement, international frame, in the next years, and then we can start really to have a more detailed look in the required technologies.
Okay, great. Thank you. Again, terrific presentation. Just to close out the evening, and again, thanks so much for our German colleagues for staying up late. Do folks have like one last really important question they want to ask before we close off the day?
Yeah, thanks. With pleasure.
Good. Okay, thank you all. Talk to you next week. And Jürgen and Uwe, again, as I said a couple times, thanks so much for staying up late.
You.
Thanks for having us.
Okay. Bye-bye, guys.